So tonight, I wanted to talk about one particular line from the lengthy piece that we read in our liturgy service tonight. And that line is, nevertheless, Zazen is an initiatory awareness. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what that means. But starting with, I wanted to look a little bit at, so where does that come from? So one of the things that we heard repeatedly kind of in different ways throughout the piece we read, and that we hear again and again in beginning instruction or the course of our practice here, is that this practice is not about doing something special with your mind. It's not about attaining a special mind that's different from the mind you already have. It's not stilling the mind, quieting the mind, or emptying the mind. Nor is it about getting into a special state, a state of bliss, a state where you feel you really deeply see into all of the great mysteries of the universe. Or a state where you feel benevolently compassionate towards all beings. All of those things can happen and sometimes do, but they are not the purpose of our practice. They're kind of side effects, they're byproducts of doing this practice. And this is a practice of opening ourselves to our lives, opening ourselves to our lives and the universe that are not separatable from each other, inevitably and inextricably bound up, co-creating each other. Self and other co-creating each other. This is the reality that we're opening ourselves to. But this doesn't come with a kind of cognitive experience necessarily. And part of what we are doing is becoming aware of the kind of programs of conditioning that are constantly running through us. And that under certain causes and conditions, certain circumstances, somebody saying something, not saying something, then we get flipped into this pattern of karmic conditioning and just acting on automatic pilot. And part of what this practice of sitting with ourselves, of encountering ourselves, is seeing how these energies of grasping, aversion, and the stories we tell ourselves take control. And this is a practice of seeing those energies arising. And those energies are part of what it means to be human. And nothing about our Zen practice, about our Zazen practice, about Buddhism in general, is about making us any less human. It's actually about opening ourselves to even more of our human capacity, of what it means to kind of show up and be ourselves. And so part of what this practice is gaining a familiarity with the functioning of those energies within us. And part of the initiatory awareness that comes from Zazen is seeing that these energies, seeing that these habit patterns, seeing that our impulses to grasp or push away are not what we had always assumed they were. Our thoughts are not ultimate truths. Thinking is not a vessel that can contain ultimate truth. Our thoughts are just thoughts. And our urges, our impulses, aren't imperatives. They aren't requirements. When we have the impulse to do something, there is the potential for choice. Choice informed by a larger context of who we mean to be, of what is useful and kind to ourselves and to others in this circumstance. And that our thoughts or our wishes about the way life ought to be and the way that life is unsatisfactory now, that there is a different kind of level, a different kind of satisfaction, a different kind of okayness that comes from just recognizing that the thing that feels like a need that things be different, it is actually just another facet of human experience. That's actually just a thought arising in this moment right now. And the thought is that contains within it a whole story about something that happened problematically in the past, or something that's going to happen that's real ominous in the future, or that great thing that's coming down the pike. But all of those things are arising right now. And to see them in their kind of right nowness, is a different way of encountering our minds and the contents of them, and a different way of encountering our lives. And it doesn't mean that that there is no use for planning, and it doesn't mean that there is no use for analysis and understanding and larger contexts. All of those things are also part of what it means to be human. And so part of that is one piece of the initiatory awareness. And that there's also someone whose practice is counting her breath recently said to me that in describing what that practice was like for her, she said, "Well, you know, I usually don't get to 10, sometimes I don't get to 5. But you know, each time I come back to 1, it's really all there. It's all there in the 1. That is a really important point. The goal is not about getting to 10 in counting our breath, but nonetheless, it's not doing nothing. Zazen isn't nothing. And but each time we come back to that 1, that wholeness, that whole thisness is really sparklingly here. And it's this gesture of coming back to 1. It's just arising of 1 of this right now. That is it. And it's not nothing. But it's also not anything particularly special. And there's a impulse. There's a kind of there's a human thing that we want to make zazen. We might want to make meditation. We want to make dharma practice something complex, something special, something categorically different from everything else. And there's a way that some of that is true, but it's different in relationship. The thing that changes is your relationship to all that arises. It isn't about causing all of these kind of inadequate feelings and these fears and these wishes, causing them to never come up, and instead replacing those set of experiences with a different set of Zen experience that then starts arising. That's not it. And instead, we're kind of opening ourselves up to this one categoryness that includes all experiences, and our relationship to that can change. And part of what comes with with this initiatory awareness, with this noticing that thoughts aren't the thoughts and reactions are not the kind of ultimate truths and last words on the matter that we thought they were, or that we'd always assumed they were. Because that's what they tell us they are, of course. Our thoughts say, I'm the ultimate truth. This is it. You really got it now. You don't have it. That's it. So or thoughts saying, you got to move. You have to move your foot right now or the world's going to end. And then part of the reason that we practice stillness is to enact the truth that is other than that commanding thought. That thought says you have to move. And then when you nonetheless don't move, then you see something about that screams command in your head, even though for all the world it feels like you have to move. And stillness is in a way the initial context in which we can have that realization, and then from there we can kind of start to expand the scope of places that we find that understanding useful, that reality useful. And part of what this does is gives us the, in a way, courage, but this is not a courage that stands in opposition to feelings of fear, but alongside it. In a way, it gives us the courage or the confidence to let all of life in, to let in more profoundly our own suffering. Part of this practice is a freedom to suffer, a freedom to hurt, to be present to the truly, truly, truly inevitable pain and dissatisfaction that comes with living. And it gives us the strength and courage and confidence to be able to be present to the suffering and pain of others without needing to enact patterns that protect ourselves, without needing to strengthen and thicken our armors and protections that hold us away from being able to meet with openness and kindness the suffering of the world, including the suffering that we can do nothing about. But the thing is that meeting that suffering from the place of taking off that armor, meeting that suffering about which we can do nothing, is really doing something. That is a very powerful action. It's an action that has ripples and ramifications throughout an endless chain of causation throughout the entire world in an important way. Throughout the entire universe, we might even say, and throughout space and time. One ancient teacher in Zen says that when one person sits zazen, the whole world sits zazen. And we might also recognize that there's a way that that principle is functioning with our meeting openly our pain, with our bearing compassionate witness. And here, compassionate just means letting it in, letting it hurt, bearing compassionate witness to the pain and suffering of others. And we can do this kind of It's always manifest in a specific instance, but that specific instance fills the entire world, fills all time and space. And part of what this practice of Zazen opens us to is what's sometimes called original nature, Buddha nature, the ground of being, reality itself. And this is not a special property that we have or don't have. It's kind of already... It's not in the category of things that can be had or not had. And I actually wanted to read a little bit about this this original nature. Really interestingly striking image from this book called Dialogues in a Dream, which is a text from a Zen text from the Rinzai School in Japan that's been very influential and kind of has been in continuous print for the last 800 years, which is pretty remarkable. Even those of you who know Dogen was out of print and largely not influential for a number of centuries before he enjoyed a relatively recent return to some rightful prominence. But this book has been exerting continuous influence. And so this is a great image, but there are caveats for taking it too literally, but we'll return to those shortly. This concern, common among people who wish to practice Zen, is based on an inadequate understanding of what the term original nature signifies. For example, if original nature were described to you as something like a worldly art, you would wonder if you were talented enough to learn it. If it were described as a transcendental doctrine or philosophy, you would worry whether you were intelligent enough to grasp it. However, having heard that original nature has nothing to do with either the mundane or the supramundane, it is senseless to wonder how to reach it. So, this thing that Zazen opens us up to, original nature, is not something that we have to earn or qualify for. It's not something that we have to be smart to attain. It's not something that we have to have had the right parents and the right upbringing and the right psychological disposition. And it's not a skill to master. Reaching the ground of original nature is not like traveling from the countryside to the capital or from Japan to China. Rather, it is as though you were asleep in your home, dreaming of enduring the sufferings of hell or enjoying the pleasures of paradise, then having a friend who is not sleeping tell you the hell and the paradise that you're seeing are nothing but illusions in your dreams. In your actual home, neither of them exists. If upon hearing these words you continue to believe that the events in your dreams are real, then you would pay no heed to your friend. Instead, you would continue trying to escape your dream sufferings or prolong your dream pleasures. However, even if you haven't awakened from this dream, if you realize that everything you do and see are simply images in a dream, and therefore see as though blind and hear as though deaf, then you are basically the same as a person who has awakened. You are someone who has attained faith in the realm of reality. And part of what this opens us up to is this unshakable, verified faith in the realm of reality. But the caveat of this image of dream and waking is that it isn't the case, and somebody else saying, in your actual house, none of these things are present. So that's a great image for the things that the things that we think we need to run away from, and the things that we grasp onto and think we need to have. These are like these are the sufferings of a dream hell, or the pleasures of a dream paradise. But there isn't a special kind of other state that we then wake up into. We don't wake up into our house, which is somewhere else, and then go about our business over there. And in that way, it also differs from the movie The Matrix, for instance. When you unplug from The Matrix, then you're in this kind of crappy spaceship, right? And in Zen, there is no crappy spaceship. You might want to write that down. Instead, what we get is a more flexible and liberated kind of capacity to engage with all of these. This reality that arises interdependently, co-created in this, and is in many ways like a dream. And recognizing the dream as dream gives us freedom, and it gives us, and it also is a source of equanimity, both in not having what we do want and being in the presence of what we wish we didn't have. And all of this comes from returning again and again to this fully embodied here-ness, this-ness, to receiving with this very body and this very mind the whole of our experience, the whole of what comes thus. And it's seeing the entire wholeness that is all right there included in just one. So, thank you, guys. I want to open up the floor for questions or comments or complaints or doubts. yeah.
Well, you know, we were just talking and I before the evening started, and I said that about liturgy that didn't usually provoke questions for me so very much. Well, that line that you read out is the one exception about Zen being an initiatory awareness, because it sounds to me like there are stages of awareness, you know, and okay, this is, you know, your practice has this initiatory awareness, and then there's, you know, that's like first grade, and then you get to go on to second and third and so forth. And you can, and that's how I hear it, but I don't know if that's what it really means.
I think it's much more binary than that. So the thing that you're kind of initiated into is having everything you need to work continuously with your life and all that arises in it. By noticing that these energies of grasping, aversion, and certainty are at play in us, and by seeing how much we are acting those things out continuously and unexaminedly. And then as we start to see those things arise, and we start to see that those seeming imperatives are just thoughts arising for us, then we have... That is the initiatory awareness that gives us the opportunity to then start to live the life we mean to be living, being the person we start to have the recognizing that we have all, right now, all the tools we need to be able to start to be the person we mean to be. And so it's a recognition that it's appreciation that there is nothing missing that you first need to get in order to start doing this. In that way, it's a initiatory awareness that is different from the 42 levels of Freemasonry or something like that.
So he would say, you realize that life is like a dream. And my reaction to that is that life is real.
Right.
They don't die, they're not here anymore, and that's real.
That's right, and that's where the analogy of dream breaks down. And it's important to recognize that dreams are real. And so another maybe less provocative image of dream is the image of a rainbow, right? So a rainbow is a real thing, like you see a rainbow, but there isn't a rainbow that you can ever grab, and if you move towards it, it moves away, and that the rainbow is only an interplay of causes and conditions and water in the atmosphere and an atmosphere and light passing through it and a vantage point and a capacity to perceive light, and all of those things together are what give rise to the experience of a rainbow. But that said, so a rainbow is not a self-existent thing that exists independent of our encounter with it, but it's not unreal, and so it isn't the case that we should encounter the suffering and sickness, old age, death, loss, change, our own suffering, the suffering of others. It isn't the case that we should encounter it with a kind of blithe indifference, because sometime we're just going to wake up from all that. That isn't the case. You're right. And recognizing how it is this kind of... recognizing the way all beings kind of arise together, recognizing the nature of the stuff that arises for us, gives us more capacity, more compassion to actually, and more strength to show up, to bear witness, to be present to these people who are, in a completely non-trivial sense, real. And our capacity to do that is enhanced as we start to see that inner and outer things aren't exactly what we've always assumed they are. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question about formal sitting and zazen as a resource. I had rather a difficult day, particularly this morning, with some anxieties about my wife's health. And it was a considerable relief to know that I was going to come here this evening and sit formally and do 45 minutes of formal sitting and kinhin. And my experience, I've done this quite a while, my experience is that is a good thing to do in these kinds of circumstances.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't quite know, you know, that's not exactly the point. But the knowledge that I can do that, and I'm likely to feel more equanimity at the end of the process than the beginning, is a very nice feeling, actually.
Yeah. And that's really important, and this also goes into the category of reminding us that Zazen is not nothing. It's not exactly what we thought it was, just like everything else. But it's also not nothing, and it is worth doing. But if you were and so what you're expressing is comes out of your own verified faith that there is a way to touch this okayness that is not dependent on circumstance, and that Zazen in a way reminds you how to do it. And so there's an important way that where we learn this skill and where we practice this skill is in Zazen. But the reality that we touch in Zazen is not unique to when we are or aren't doing Zazen. And you're also really inspiringly kind of pointing to the way that Sangha and what we create together is empowering and supporting and grounding, but not because of something we get, but rather from giving us the strengthening our capacity to just be with ourselves and our life. So I didn't hear a question in all that.
Well, a question was, somehow, if I have a question, I was thinking, is it really appropriate to do this for that purpose?
Right. And so that's a really important question. If you were using your Zazen to replace one feeling with another feeling, to kind of manufacture a veneer of calm to lather on top of the anxiety, that is not making good use of Zazen. I don't think that's what you're doing. I think that what you are recognizing, that for you, you've verified that when there's all of this anxiety arising for you, that taking the time to sit and really be with your life as it is, then you're able to find equanimity with it. And that's starting with the crucial step of being with all of our difficulty as it is, as opposed to running from it, or using Zazen to become a kind of haven where we can hide from our lives. But actually, what you're describing is using Zazen to remind you that you don't need to run.
If I could make a comment on that, I sat where it was most difficult. difficult experience for me. You know, I sat with a number of different groups, and I sat with groups that have used mu as a matter, and that's an extremely strong concentration practice, which I found I don't like to do in times of trouble, because you can sit there in a situation where your mind is not at ease, and you can do mu, and it's exactly what you were saying there. It puts this level of calm, but you're not really looking at what's going on. You're just going mu.
Right.
Yeah, and that's a practice I've actually kind of backed off from.
Yeah. And this is how shikantaza, just sitting, differs from a concentration practice. And it's much more useful, much more flexible, and in my experience, much more worthwhile. Thank you.
What about the aspect of practice? What does it really mean to practice? What do we have to do to actually practice? Is that something that unfolds during the practice? What is the process we have to go through every time that we sleep?
Sure. Did you want to take a shot?
I'm still trying to decipher the question. What? So you want to know? No, I'm sorry. Ask me again.
Well, let me try to rephrase. So I think that first of all, practice has two uses, two different meanings. There's practice like we practice a tennis stroke or practice a piece of music. And there's practice, like you've got to put it into practice. You've got to do it in practice, not just in theory. And so there's two different kind of uses of practice. They both kind of overlap. But it's important to recognize that we use that English word for both things. So in terms of the practicing a stroke or practicing a piece of music, what we're doing is practicing not being owned by our thoughts. What we're doing is practicing this gesture of unhooking and returning just to this one that contains everything. We're practicing this exact skill over and over 100,000 times in the course of one 25-minute period of zazen. We're practicing this one very skill that is exactly the skill that we then can employ when we're not sitting on our cushion. It's that awareness of when we're getting caught up in our habit patterns. And then when that awareness arises, then we have to put into practice we have to then actually be the person we mean to be within the limits of the possible. And then we fall short, and then we do it repeatedly. So, and part of the role of practice on the cushion is kind of as Nick is describing, to gain familiarity, to really acquaint ourselves with this world of okayness beyond category, with this equanimity that is inclusive of disturbance, and we need to take special opportunity to get acquainted with that, because it isn't apparent necessarily through the if we haven't spent some time on the cushion. Because it's there, but it's too hard to see. And so and that also is pointing to the quality of the initiatory awareness. Do practice, do sit, and do put it into practice in your life. Is that in the ballpark of what you're asking?
For some reason, when I try to practice, I encounter personally something interesting that's both something new that I do when I practice, but at the same time something that's not new. So it has sort of like two dimensions. But the moment that I practice, it's both something that's real there when I practice, but it's real also because I practice.
What are you... okay. Okay. What are you using the word practice to mean? When you practice, what is it that you're saying you're doing?
Sort of both the two concepts that you were.
So
both the practice that I do, like striking the ball, and do putting into practice what I try.
And I really like that you observe that there is something that is interesting that arises. And I think that is an interesting that includes feels nice and sometimes doesn't feel so nice. And this quality of curiosity, of looking, of receiving what comes as a result or not as a result, is this quality of investigating and being curious and being open to whatever comes is the practice. It's also a level of the practice. And so there isn't something to necessarily figure out, but keep practicing and keep noticing what arises. And there's not an end and there's not an answer. That's the best I can do with that formation of the question. Thank you, Gonzalo.
Maybe it's something along the lines of a case study and analysis of that. But so the interesting thing that says that is on and off question, the initiatory awareness is always available. My initiatory awareness is great, right?
The awareness is always available. For most human beings, in fact, we need Zazen to be initiated into that awareness. So, and that's why it's No, it's not that. That's not what we're talking about. Okay.
But you could sort of say what you're saying before about, you know, things that come out of the body and practice for it. Certainly sit on a cushion and stuff then. Offer some more advantages maybe to sit in the part of the initiatory awareness. That's a bit different maybe for me anyway than washing dishes or walking around. But potentially I'll
right. It is potentially different on the cushion versus washing dishes, but part of what we can see on in our Zazen practice is that isn't inherently true, right? That isn't inherently true in the nature of dish doing versus cushion sitting, right? It's only true because of what arises for us, what we bring to it, what we do with what arises for us.
When you come to a point where you realize that Zazen or Zen or your religion, whatever, is not going to cure things for you or make your life better, it's not going to cure things, it puts you into this wonderful state of being this great person. But what you do realize is that things open up for better or worse, or they can't open up, you know, sometimes nothing opens up. days of fog. And so, to me, practice is sort of a constant reminder. It goes hand in hand with a constant reminder of I'm not going to get it because I don't think that there is sort of a place that is reached. And because there's not a place that is reached, all you can do is sit and practice and see what comes, because you won't be at a point where you say, oh, that's it. I don't have to practice anymore.
I win.
And so Zazen and just practice in general is that, to me, it's that constant reminder that I'm not going to get it, or I'm not going to get something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And Sophie?
That James has said, you know, you're not going to reach any goal, you know, and then like, this idea we have about attaining enlightenment. And I was just wondering, is there something that's different about the enlightened person?
There is a the answer is yes and no, and also I don't know about this enlightenment thing anyhow. On the yes side is the thing that's different is our capacity to flexibly respond as all of our human difficulties arise and manifest for us. On the no side is the fact that all of our human difficulties continue to arise and manifest for us. So it isn't that difficulty stops. For instance, there's in the Pali Canon, the teachings of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, there's a passage that's like a big paragraph long talking about how much pain the Buddha was in when he got a splinter. It was like a splinter lodged under his nail, and it goes on at great length that it was enormous and racking and painful and awful and hurting, and they were really, really making the point that so the Buddha was not happy with the splinter. Splinter hurts for the Buddha. And what this practice does is enlarge our capacity to be able to be with that. So you are tapping into one of the great arguments within the Buddhist tradition: is enlightenment sudden or is it gradual? And there are many, many books and centuries of monks debating various sides on this. To a certain degree, the Soto school of Zen teaches that it's gradual. The Rinzai school of Zen is all about cultivating this sudden breakthrough. Our tradition of Zen is actually a Soto-Rinzai hybrid, so we have the sudden and we have the gradual, and they're both true. I hope that cleared it up for you. All right. Thank you, everybody, and thank you all for your generous diving in.